The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with the clip on tight and a rub on tan.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Zoe Chance. By night, Zoe is a crime-fighting superhero, but during her waking hours, she's a marketing professor teaching influence and persuasion at the Yale School of Management. Her research has been published in the Harvard Business Review, The Economist, and The New York Times. Her framework for behavior change is the foundation for Google's food program. Zoe previously helped market the Barbie brand at Mattel. She got her doctoral degree at Harvard and is currently working on a book project on influence and behavioral economics, currently titled Woo the Gator. Zoe Chance, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Kelly.
So one of the books that comes up most often on this podcast is Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, where Kahneman talks about System 1 and System 2 parts of the brain. I really like your spin on this because you give it a little more poetry to that same idea, I think, by using the terms alligator brain and the court.
Thank you. So Danny Kahneman is a god, and he's as smart as the rest of us put together.
Right.
And yet I have a beef with him and all the other behavioral economists who created this nomenclature of System 1 and System 2 to understand how the brain works, because it's really hard to wrap our brain around.
Right.
So I use the alligator and the court metaphor to simplify it so that we can get it and remember it. But these are the same system, System 1 and System 2, thinking fast and thinking slow, that Danny Kahneman talks about in his book.
And I thought, again, the story, and I don't think it's been told on this podcast, of the study they did of judges in Israel illustrates this thing remarkably well.
Yeah, it's shocking, and I find it really hilarious, and this is partly why I call System 2 the court. So System 2 is our slow, conscious, deliberate, effortful decision-making system in our brain. And these are metaphors, of course. This is not actual parts of our brain.
Right.
But it operates like a court. So it hears all the evidence, and then it deliberates and tries to make the best choice. But the reality is that even courts operate a lot more like alligators in the real world. And that research study that you're mentioning came out a few years ago. It was done on a group of Israeli judges who are making parole decisions. So criminals are coming up, and the judge has to decide, do we send you out into society or do we send you back to jail? So the difficult decision is let you go, send you back out into society on parole. And the easy decision, of course, they're a criminal, send them back to jail. And the spin on this, the researchers were just looking at decision and time of day. And in the morning, when these judges are fresh and their brains are fully functioning, they have plenty of attention, they're not distracted, they're not hungry, 2/3 of the criminals are getting let out on parole. They're making the hard decision. But there are 2 food breaks during the day. And what the researchers find is that the proportion of these criminals that are getting let out on parole dwindles and dwindles and dwindles till the first food break. Right before that, it's zero. Everybody gets sent back to jail, and the judges go out, they eat some food, they get refreshed. And then again, 2/3 of the criminals are getting let out on parole. They're making the hard decision, dwindles, dwindles, dwindles again till before the next food break, in the same pattern. So as the judges are getting tired and they're getting hungry and they're getting distracted, they're using System 1, their alligator brain, instead of making decisions like the court. And if the actual court, people who are hired specifically to be making the best, most rational decisions, are really using their gut in many of these cases, we can trust that's how the rest of us operate as well.
Oh, absolutely. And it's as simple as, you know, people who tune out, right? You know, you talk about someone tuning out if you know what someone is going to say. So in improvisation, we kind of have like an app for that. You know, we have these specific exercises that force you to listen to the ends of people's sentences. And it every time we do it and we unpack the exercise, everyone's like, it's so difficult. That was so hard. And that you realize, it was hard to listen to the end of someone's sentence.
I know your last word exercise that you wrote about in Yes And is great, and I want to use it for my class next year.
Do it, and it's going to drive people crazy, but then they realize, well, maybe it's because I'm not listening. And I think improvisation in general is almost a practice in moving with agility and grace between your alligator and your court brain, because you have to absorb all this information that someone's saying, and then you have to spit back stuff in real time. So it kind of is almost like an exercise for those two parts of the brain.
Yeah, I'm so curious about how and where the court brain comes into play in improvisation, because it's so beautiful that people can just act and respond so immediately and so quickly, and it seems like lots of times it's tapping into your unconscious.
Yeah. I mean, this is a study we've got to do, right, to figure it all out. In general, I think that for an improviser, they're moving fast and slow. So they are needing to sort of recall all kinds of events from their life that they can add into their stories that while they're sort of writing on stage. But then they completely stop everything when the other person is improvising, because they have to be wholly attentive to what they're saying. And I think that's where the sort of dyad switch happens.
Yeah. Yeah, and especially I'm thinking in something like long-form improv, where you have actors making exits and coming back again and tying back the threads from previous parts and just
yep, that too.
Creating this beautiful, exquisitely balanced work of art.
Yeah. That's completely, I think, how it works. All right, so you talk a lot about getting attention, and understanding how our brains work allows marketing folks a much more scientific way to reach consumers. And you talk about Procter & Gamble's moments of truth. Can you explain on that a little bit?
Absolutely. Procter & Gamble coined the phrase moments of truth, and people in the industry will call it MOTS for M-O-T, and there's Z-MOTS and F-MOTS and S-MOTS, but everybody in marketing research has learned about this from Procter & Gamble because it is so effective and so critical to capture people's attention at the right moment when they are most receptive to what you have to offer. So either they're most motivated, need it most desperately, or it's already top of mind. And a story that I share with my class, one example from P&G, is our marketing team in Beirut, Lebanon, was selling Bonux laundry detergent. And they have to figure out, all right, when are people going to be thinking about laundry detergent? When do they care about laundry detergent? And like, really, of course, Kelly, none of us are thinking about laundry detergent, right?
Except when we're doing it.
Yeah. So how can you reach people when they're doing laundry? And you can't advertise on television. They're not watching television. They're doing laundry. Like radio ads, no. Print ads, no. Billboards, no. They're doing laundry. However, in Beirut, most of the people who are doing laundry, who's everybody, they live in these high-rise apartment buildings, and they have washers, they don't have dryers, and they hang their laundry out to dry on the balconies. And the brilliant insight that the P&G marketing team had is actually we can reach them, we can capture their attention at that moment of truth when they're doing laundry, hanging their clothes on the balcony by advertising on the tops of buses. So they put these print ads on the tops of buses, and it became very famous. Career Builder, the job search website, then also stole their thunder, and they put ads on the tops of buses that say, "Don't jump, Career Builder."
Because other people are on balconies for other reasons than laundry, I guess.
That's the idea. Hopefully not actually true, but they got a lot of PR out of that as well.
Yeah, that's such a fascinating. I mean, it's a great story. It's interesting, creative, and clever. And then, of course, then I can't stop thinking about, all right, where are people thinking when they want comedy, or where are people thinking when they want improvisation? And you know, it sort of boggles the mind because you have to look at it completely differently. I want to ask you about tell me if I'm pronouncing this correctly, the Zeigarnik effect.
You're pronouncing it perfectly.
Okay.
Yes.
So explain what that is, and I have a theory I want to throw by you.
Okay. Okay, great. The Zygarnik effect, because it's really hard to pronounce, I call it open loops.
Also. Oh, there you go. Mm-hmm.
The Zygarnik effect is the idea that as long as something is in a state of incompletion, as long as there's an open loop and it's not resolved, our brain is holding it in the RAM, the easy access part. And so our attention is being grabbed by this thing that we're uncertain about, curious about. And then as soon as it gets resolved, our brain can move it out of RAM and we let it go. And the story about that is Bluma Zygarnik, who's a psychologist who was getting her PhD, and I believe it was the 1930s in Czechoslovakia. She's at a coffee shop with her friend because, of course, that's where PhD students are. And her friends and she have noticed that there's this one waiter who has a brilliant memory, and he can remember every single food item and drink item that everybody at the table orders. He never uses a pen or piece of paper. He comes back and brings all their orders perfectly every time, even in a big group. So they test him one day, and they all, after he's delivered everything to each person, they cover up their food and their drinks with their napkins, and they call him back, and they say, okay, quiz time, tell us again, what did we all get? And he can't remember. Even though he's just brought them all of their food, he can't remember what it was because the open loop was closed and he put it out of his mind. And this is exactly why, Kelly, when we cram for a final exam, because we didn't study when we were supposed to, and we cram the night before, and we remember hopefully a lot of it, we take the test, but then what if we had to do the same final exam the next day? We'd be completely screwed because we remember none of it.
Yep, completely. I love it. So there's an easy leap here to understand the Zygarnik effect as it relates to improvisers, like people who want, and I used to always say a lot of people got into improvisation because they were lazy and didn't want to memorize scripts, and so they could just go do the work. So that seems like an easy, but then I think about the audience for improvisation, because improvisation really is kind of a niche art form. So at Second City, we use improvisation to make comedy, and most audiences love comedy, but as far as pure improvisational theater goes, that tends to be a required taste for people, and I think it might be because of the Zygarnik effect, because in really good improvisation, so many of these loops are open and never get resolved, and that could be very unappealing for certain brains. And so I'm kind of wondering what makes an audience love improvisation. What's going on there? Because that seems to be opposite what feels good in our brain.
That's fascinating. I never thought about all of those open loops that don't get closed, but of course that's true, and you know I'm a huge improv fan. There is this sense of aliveness that comes from these open loops being created and stimulating curiosity. And in a crass way, this is the same thing going on with clickbait, right?
So
I'm not saying that improvisers are like clickbait artists, but it is this visceral feeling of, oh, what is it? What's going to happen, right? So you're creating a lot of curiosity and a high level of attention for people who are sitting there in a good improv show.
Yeah.
For sure. But as far as what distinguishes people who like improv from people who don't, I don't know. Honestly, I didn't realize people don't like improv. I just thought it was great for everybody.
Well, and it's funny though. I mean, when my parents were alive, my dad was they're both love theater, and they went to Second City forever. That was like the first thing they did when they moved to Chicago. So they were thrilled I was working in Second City. They loved the Second City shows. And then when I produced a long form improv show, the first one that Second City did, called Lois Kaz in 1994, it was a huge hit. But they were baffled. They literally were like, we don't get it. And I realized, you know, it's like the jazz metaphor is actually probably easier to understand because, you know, a lot of people like jazz, but avant-garde jazz is sometimes really hard to listen to. So I don't know. It's an interesting thing to look into. All right. So You purchased a pedometer and it almost destroyed your life.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Right?
Yes, I have a TED Talk in which I share that story. And the pedometer really, it was destroying my life. It was destroying my marriage. It actually hurt my health. And the person that it brought me closer to was my little daughter, who was 3 at the time, because I would put the pedometer on her and have her run around the house so I could get more points. The pedometer was hijacking my attention so brilliantly by using behavioral science in every possible way you could engage people's attention and motivation, giving goals, creating games, little pop-up messages. We get our attention so easily hijacked by distractions like text messages and emails popping up, and the pedometer would do that same thing, like, hey, challenge, do, you know, 200 steps right now, and we'll give you all these extra points for, you know, this crazy, stupid little world that was created by the video game developers of Farmville. That was another crazy, stupid little world, but similarly addictive.
Mm.
And unfortunately, it seems that evidence has been coming out in enough quantity now to find that these pedometers, Strive is what I had, and Fitbits, they're not actually doing much to move the needle on people's health outcomes.
Hmm. Yeah, and you said in that talk, too, that self-control is a limited resource.
Yeah. And the thing that should be helpful about self-control being a limited resource when you make things like health apps and devices addictive is you can't resist them, right? So the mm-hmm. average Strive user, at least when I checked, was checking their pedometer 20-something times a day. And I definitely was also. And we were going online and we were trading tips with each other and making matrices and trying to understand how it worked. But self-control gets depleted so that the more you have to resist temptation, whatever the temptation is, that was a relatively healthy one. But it can be the temptation of, you know, checking Facebook, the temptation of not eating something. People are passing around cookies at a meeting, right? Mm-hmm. The more you resist temptation, the more you diminish your overall self-control resources. And that's partly what we saw in the Israeli judges' study, mm-hmm. that their self-control is getting diminished and diminished, as well as their cognitive resources to even pay attention, to be able to make the tough decision when they're hungry and when they just need to take a break.
Right, right. And I can't remember whether it was you who said this in the talk or not, but I like the idea that it might be better to use like contextual clues for yourself, like laying out exercise clothes at night, you know, or keeping like hand weights near when you're likely to be sitting for long periods of time. There's other ways you can kind of trick your brain into doing things that are healthy for you.
Yeah, and I've talked to a lot of people that really beat themselves up for not doing the things that they know they should do. Like, pretty much any of us who've ever created a New Year's resolution haven't followed through with it, and we yeah. know that we don't follow through with our best intentions. And it's because we don't have enough willpower, and we can't rely on our willpower. So anything that we can do to help ourselves reduce the friction in making the choices that we want to make, it can work. Like a silly little example that my family did in our house was we put all of our junk food in this opaque container in the same cabinet that it had always been in.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's easy to open up the cabinet and just grab whatever you see. And we were as guilty of that as anybody else. And our junk food started molding in its packages just because it was in the same place, but we couldn't see it when we opened
wow.
up the door.
That's interesting. You know, when I grew up, I'm not a big sweets guy, and I always thought that's because we had massive amounts of sweets available in my house 24/7.
So it wasn't exciting for
yeah,
you, huh?
It wasn't exciting for me.
So it didn't grab your attention in that way.
Yeah.
It's just
yeah.
always there.
It was always there. So this goes nicely into I want to talk to you about a paper you wrote with the great Michael Norton about self-deception.
Michael Norton is great.
Yep. So my wife and I have a running joke from the various trips we've taken to Europe over the years with Second City casts. Inevitably, we'll take the cast out for meals. And although I have a terrible sense of direction, I would just start walking and everyone would follow me. And I think that's what you call self-deceptive overconfidence.
So you thought you knew where you were going?
No. I mean, I just sort of assumed, like, I don't know at all. She would have to catch up with me, like, no, you're not at all going. And everyone would follow me. They'd start moving with me. You talk about in the paper this idea that sometimes self-deception can, you know, carry to other people where they then assume, like, oh, like, you know, he seems like he knows what he's doing. I'm going to follow him.
Yeah, it's interesting when you talk to a lot of people, especially in sales, top salespeople will tell you that the most powerful force of influence is certainty. So mm-hmm. the more certainty you can convey, the more other people will be persuaded and go along with you, which is even body language, right? Just
right.
if you're walking with purpose. I had a friend of mine who was closing kajillions of dollars in big deals, and her close would be, I definitely know that, you know, this is going to be a great thing for what you need. And it's not even proper grammar, but people were so persuaded by, oh, if it's definite, yes.
Wow.
And this paper on self-deception, one of them that we wrote was looking also examining where did this come from. And a lot of people think that self-deception evolved to prevent lie detection. Because what other people can perceive about us is not truth or dishonesty, but discomfort and guilt. So if we can deceive ourselves when we've lied to somebody, and if we can convince ourselves that, well, maybe it's true, then we don't show those outward signs of lying.
That's really interesting. How does status play into self-deception?
It's a great question. I'm trying to think of what research has been done directly looking at status, and I can think of one paper by some Chinese researchers. I'm trying to remember their names. I'll have to look it up. But they were, it was people deceiving another person that was either high status or low status.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they were finding people were more self-deceptive when they were trying to deceive the high status others than the low status others.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah, which was supporting that theory that we try to not be detected.
Yeah, it's interesting because status is such an important ingredient both in improvisation and comedy. And I know there was a paper that came out recently about status in comedy, and that people who used comedy effectively were perceived to have high status. And that was the same for people who used like dirty comedy or inappropriate comedy. But those people also were perceived to be less competent.
Hmm.
Which I think
it's interesting. Mm-hmm. I'd love to read that paper.
Yeah. No, it's very cool. Are there social benefits to self-deception?
Absolutely. There's and research has shown that pretty clearly, that people who are self-deceived convey more confidence and then are better liked.
Wow.
As a result. Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right. So you also have talked about optimism. You wrote, not only do optimists work harder to achieve their expected results, they gain direct utility from optimism. How does that play out?
That we feel great. We feel great about ourselves and we feel great about our future. So the direct utility is just a feeling of happiness that the future is going to be rosy, rather than allowing ourselves to ruminate on some negative possibilities. So one of the benefits of self-deception certainly is just allowing us to feel good in the moment, being optimistic. And another benefit is allowing us to work harder toward those goals. So if you're an entrepreneur, for example, you've really got to be optimistic if you have any possible chance of making your business work. Although part of the challenge that entrepreneurs have is being overly optimistic and potentially self-deceptively so, right?
Wow. It's such a game between those two things, right? You know, so you need to model the success, but at the same time, you can't just like live in that land because it just might not be true.
Yeah. And what makes it even more mushy and complicated is that we can't really know when we're being self-deceived.
Hmm.
Because that's the definition. If you've actually deceived yourself, you didn't realize that happened. But we can at least ask other people for feedback and do a much better job of that.
Well, that's it, right? I mean, that's where we live and we survive and we thrive, is when we're so socialized in a positive way that we've got other people who'll mark us, right? Who'll tell us that when we're off on the wrong path.
Right, and people who we will trust. Right? Because many of us get negative feedback and it just makes us double down and work even harder to prove them wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so we're coming to the end of our conversation, and one of the things that we always do on this podcast is ask our guest for a yes and story. So, you know, you've come across something in your life where you would normally say no, but there's probably one point in your life where you didn't just say yes, you said yes and it could be a work thing, it could be a life thing. Do you have a yes and story for us?
Oh my gosh. I use yes and all the time. And it's funny being on the spot to think of one because I had thought of a bunch. But, well, actually, just a couple of days ago, I mentioned to you briefly earlier, I used this when I was invited to speak by somebody who I knew you would really connect with. Mm-hmm. And it was in Chicago where you are. And I said, yes, great. I would love to come. And why don't you invite Kelly Leonard also, because you guys would love each other. And he said, of course, Kelly has already plugged his book here. He's fantastic. One of my favorite people. So I use yes and a lot. I use it a lot when I'm negotiating public speaking mm-hmm. arrangements and will be say, yes, I'll do this for you. And let's create a survey for your guests so we can make it interactive. And then I can bring their problems to the table and handle it. Or yes. And can I invite some people who would be really interested in your conference and bring them here? I try to use yes and as a way of life.
Ah, that's the best. We're going to cut. That's going to be the clip we use for every other podcast.
Thank you.
Zoe Chance, thank you for coming on the show.
It was a pleasure, Kelly. Well, I've been working in a coal mine going down.